Right, now we're on to side B, and we're standing beneath the most wonderful rhododendron you will possibly ever see for size, unless you go to the Himalayas, where they come from. We don't normally associate rhododendrons as being trees, but this is certainly a very fine specimen. Rhododendron Sir Robert Peel, it's not terribly spectacular in terms of its trusses, you know, flower shapes and sizes, but it does make a very magnificent tree. And flowers in August, which used to be the time of the school holidays, but of course they've changed those now. Now, if we look back across, we're now at the landing at the southern end of the lake. If we look back towards the pump house, you'll see what a magnificent tree that Torrey pine is. And I was very thrilled just at about the time I retired in 1990, and I think it was just after that. You'll see on a branch coming out this way, sorry ducks, coming out this way, a little cluster of twigs. That's the nest of a grey reef heron. Yes, a few years ago they actually came in and nested there, which is quite a thing. Now, this is one of the great significances of the change from the Pinus radiata to the great variety of plants we have here. The monoculture effect of the pines didn't attract native birds greatly at all. But once they started to be removed and a variety of other species of plants were put in, trees in particular, and a positive effort was made to include in that trees that would feed birds, both directly and indirectly through insects and so on, the native birds started coming back into this valley. And for a long time, the pigeons have bred here. But it wasn't until 1990 that the tuis actually bred here. Now, tuis weren't uncommon. Used to come in the spring when koi and that were in flower. But then they'd migrate away again as the food sources reduced. They would come in winter too. I've forgotten. I've already told you about them coming in for these camellias. Look, there's a tree just beside us here in flower. And if you want to see tuis, there is one there now. Well, isn't that wonderful? Yeah, I was going to say, if you want to be absolutely certain of showing a visitor a tuis, come into Pohikura Park during the day and stand here. And if they're not here, they'll be in the ones up near the office. They go through these bushes several times a day, and you can almost guarantee to show to be able to see them. There he is. He's right out on front of us now. That's wonderful. Right on cue, Tui. Good on you. And they're not frightened. You know, I mean, you can be within 3 or 4 metres of them. At this time of the year, they know that the camellias are here, and in they come. Sometimes you'll see the bellbirds, and quite frequently the wax eyes. Now, isn't that incredible to be right in the middle of a city and to be able to show people tuis? It's just marvellous. And I'd be very, very surprised if we don't see pigeons on the course of our journey.
Do you have seen their nests, the tui nests?
I have seen only one. They are very, very difficult to first find and secondly to climb to. They often seem to nest in things like trees like rimu, and it's very, very difficult to see them for a start. And rimu is not an easy tree to climb, a very, very unpleasant sort of tree to climb. But I've only ever known of two or three tuis nests. But they do actually nest here. Of course, this was the second lake, this fountain lake was the second lake that was formed a few years after the first one. And with the enclosure of, with the damming of the stream and the formation of the lakes, waterfowl became a possibility. So again, the wildlife increased. And it really is that the record of wildlife that's been recorded in Pohikura Park, including unusual things like, what's the big parrot? Oh.
Native parrot?
Yeah, native parrot. Yeah. Right. No, not the kia, the other one. The kaka, yeah. Sorry if I got that wrong. Yeah, we had several of those. And the last time the Friends of the Park came out, we actually saw a native falcon. Now, that is not the harrier hawk, but the true native falcon that came and sat in the trees above the bandstand. Oh, it's winter. It's dropped its leaves. Yeah, no, it is a deciduous oak. One of the, I think it's the scarlet oak of North America. Now, we're standing here at the one of the entrances to the palm tree lawn. There's the tui singing. Lovely. Yeah. It doesn't require very much imagination to see why it was called a palm tree lawn. Palm tree right in the middle of it, which is it still tests the experts. There's several to see. Those are fan palms. That's a more conventional palm. But there's a little bit of doubt over their actual naming. And subsequently, other palms have been put around the area to increase the palm content, so to speak. The tree in the side of the lawn there is a Judas tree, Cursus siliquestris, and you'll see it's rather incredible shape. Now, I will take you down towards there, into the lawn, because there's a couple of things there I want you to see. Before perhaps we go down there, have a look at the tree on the other side of the lawn. That's the Metasequoia glyptus triboides, the dawn redwood from China, which until 1947 or 48 was thought to be extinct because it had only been found in fossil form. And some botanists from the Arnold Arboretum in America went into China at that time, and they found living specimens. They brought out seed, and I think they brought out cuttings also, and they were successful. And very quickly that tree was not only brought back into cultivation, but it was spread right throughout the world. And that is one of five trees, I think, that was brought to New Zealand. Mm-hmm. So it's one of the first plantings of that species in modern time, so to speak. Another one is at Tupari, and Sir Russell Matthews always skited because his was the tallest one, because he put it in a place where it was pushed up. I think the largest one, you can interpret things all sorts of different ways. Russell reckoned he had the tallest. The largest is supposed to be in Nelson, and then this one is a third one, and there are a couple of others elsewhere, I think. So that's an historic tree in terms of its presence here. We're going under another fine specimen of the pereri, and you'll find its little flowers on the ground here. It flowers over a very, very long period. It produces fruits which are very, very favoured by the pigeons in particular. I brought you to show you this tree because this is one of Pukekura Park's most infamous trees. This is the parapara, or birdcatcher. And you might think that's a little bit of a funny sort of a thing to call it, but it does in fact catch birds. Now, there are not supposed to be any means of proving that to you here, but possibly there will be. It produces fruits which have very, very sticky cases. Having said that, I can't see any at the moment, but never mind. I'll just have another little bit of a look around here. Yeah, there will be some up higher. I was just hoping to get them. Oh, yeah, they're probably not ripe. I'll ding a few off and they're all falling to pieces. No, I don't think those have come off to be... anyway, I might be wasting your time a little bit. Anyway, they've all been very good boys and girls and tidied the tree up. If you come round this other side of the tree, you'll see what the fruit's are like. This is the fruit here, and I think if I ding that one up there, there's nobody from the parks department looking at the moment. See how handy it is to have a stick. Now, just hand that round. Oh, it's sticky. Oh, yes, there we go. Did that come from what I hit? Well, here we go. No, that's the ultimate. What happens is when a larger bird touches those with its feet, they'll stick to it and it'll fly away. Unfortunately, what happens is that insects coming along and walking over that get stuck to it. It's very, very sticky, I think you'll agree. Pardon me. Insects then stick to it, and quite a number of our birds are insect eaters, the little ones. So they see the insects sticking there, and they think, well, this is an easy feed, and go in, and they, in turn, get stuck. It is so very sticky, and you'll see the complex nature of the fruit, of the clusters of fruit, rather. They start to flap around, and it's just like a fly being in a spider web. They get more and more tangled up,
and die.
They will die. There's no question about that. When we've found them, and periodically, you know, you'll see them lying here. I have tried every solvent that I can possibly think of, and other people have been able to think of, and I cannot disrupt that. That adhesive, if they've got it on them, that's I don't know any way of saving them.
Is there any advantage to the tree as far as?
Probably not directly. No, I think it's one of these coincidental things. I'm sure that the fact
that spread of seed,
not
me,
yeah. Spreading.
Well, on a big bird, no problem. You know, the big bird will fly away with it. It's got the power to get itself away, and it'll probably only stick to its feet anyway. Or it might stick to a bill of a big bird if it was feeding on the fruit. The fruit doesn't look very attractive or doesn't smell sweet or anything. But anyway, the ultimate record in Pukekura Park is that with a small bird caught, a mopuk came along and tried to take the small bird. It, in fact, did get caught. No, it's a native tree.
Native?
Yes. Oh, yes. Yeah, Parapara is the name of it. Hamelia dendron brunonianum. Or Pisunia. The staff are supposed to go around and take all the fruits off it, but you can see it's quite a big task getting to it. Because it's a tree, nearly 10 metres tall, isn't it? Okay, that's the horror story for the day. We've got another native tree here above us. And my goodness, there is a berry on it too, or a fruit on it too. Can you see the fruit there about the size of a cherry? Well, that is a very, very important food source for the pigeons. That's the miro, our native miro. Rather like it, the growth looks very, very much like a yew tree, which of course is not a native. But when in full fruit, the whole tree will be festooned with those hundreds of those red fruits on it, and the pigeons will feed copiously on it. And I don't know if there's any that have fallen down. Yes, here we go. There's one. You'll find a few more here. And if you're interested in fragrances, you smell that. It's not unpleasant. It's not unpleasant. Have a smell at the fruit, because it smells just like turpentine. Okay, we'll move on back to Smith Walk. I didn't mention, but the walk we came along past from the sports ground to the past the fountain lake. I'll keep on walking because I'm taking too much time here. I can see that. It's called Smith Walk, and the reason for it being Smith Walk. I'm walking backwards and I'm nearly onto it again now. This is Smith Walk. Goes around the fountain lake there towards the hatchery lawn. And we are going to follow it down this way, down to towards Gilbert Street. It's named after W.W. Smith, who was superintendent here from 1908 until 1920. And he was a world-renowned ornithologist. And my goodness, listen to those trees. Anyway, it was he who, during his custodianship here, raised kiwis, the first kiwis raised in captivity. And interestingly enough, it was on an island, which is where the fountain now is. In other words, to build a fountain in 1954, they had to take an island away, and it was on that island that he had raised kiwis previously. He was a very clever man, very highly respected man. So we're walking down Smith Walk. It is actually called Smith Walk to commemorate the fact that he is reputed to have done a lot of the planting of native trees in the park, and many of them are featured down this walk. We're, for example, going through now under Pohutukawa's. We happen to have another North American oak there, but we've got a rimu above us there, and then there's kaikateas. The kaikatea is New Zealand's tallest tree, goes to a height of 50 metres, which is something like 150 feet when it's at its best, and it produces a very fine timber, which was not used so much in earlier days except as timber for butterboxes, because it was a very clean, white, pale timber, and it didn't have fragrance. The tree back beyond, before we come to this one, was, you'll see in it a black tube. That is a possum bait station, where periodically somebody will come along with some pellets and load it up, and hopefully any possums in the locality will come along and pull them out of the bottom and feed on them. Possums are a real menace. Incidentally, there, that tree is regarded as a noxious weed, or an undesirable tree in the Auckland area. I'd sort of encourage people to plant it if they want to plant for native birds, for pigeons, because it fruits now. We'll see it. You can see it out here ahead of us, above us. You might see it when we get down into clearer.
What is it called again?
It's the lily pili, or Eugenia smithii. Yeah. These are quite large specimens of it. But it's an Australian plant, yes. There you have the pink berries. Look, they are winter bearing, and of course the pigeons really love them. But that has a downside in some areas, because the pigeons then fly away. and spread the seed all over the place, and it's becoming a threat in places like the Waitakere Ranges, where the trees will grow quite freely. You can see they're quite large specimens here. Again, that is a place where in the winter you can probably see pigeons feeding. It's one of the food sources in the winter. They're on there now? Oh, yeah. Sorry? Yeah. No, it's not. The tree is an Australian tree. Yeah. But our natives are not too fussy about that. They'll eat Australian food if they have to.
Same way.
Hmm?
It all goes down the same
yes,
way.
Yes, yeah. The pigeons have a habit, which was their downfall in many cases. They will feed gluttonously on a single type of food, so like lily pilly fruit, or if you like, or miro, and then they will go to a branch which where they feel comfortable, and they'll just sit there and digest the food and drop the bits out the tail end, and that's some one thing, but they will do the same thing tomorrow, and they will do the same thing the day after that, and when they've got a food source, they will repeat this sort of feeding pattern and invariably go back to the very same branch every time, to the point where I have seen a mound of miro berries, hundreds of them in one mound where a pigeon has just come to a certain spot every day after it's fed on miro fruits. And in actual fact, in some conditions where you're looking for pigeons, you don't look up into the trees, you look on the ground. And you never make the mistake of finding one down there and then looking up to see where the bird is. Not wise.
Quite a big bird.
It's a big bird, it says. In fact, the early settlers, I understand, called them flying pies. The reason was they used to have what they call a 410 shotgun, which was fine pellets, and they could actually, stand outside the cookhouse sometime and just shoot them, and they're so fat and plump, they virtually explode when they hit the ground. Now, I don't want to go past this. We're now at the little bridge which gives access to the playground across there. But there's a little plaque here where we're going to see the waterfall, water wheel below us there. We'll go actually down and have a look, close look at it. But this bridge has quite a bit of significance, really. When the water wheel was built as the 1976 Centennial Project, there was a very scungy old conventional bridge across there which used to shudder whenever you walked across it. And we knew that we would have, having generated a lot more interest in this area, we would have to replace the bridge. And we were pretty reluctant to do it because we didn't have the money, having spent it all on the water wheel, we didn't have the money to build a bridge which we thought would be appropriate to that scene, because it's a very dominant feature when you go down to the water wheel and look up. That bridge is a skyline feature, so to speak. And we knew that it would be desirable to have an attractively shaped bridge there. And about that time, a bridge of this type, this humpback type, had been put into a reserve in Bell Block across the little stream there. And we thought, oh, we're going to have to buy one of those somehow, get the money to do that somehow. And it went on and on and on, and the funds never became available. You see, Pukekura Park is such a magic place because they have never had enough money to do what they wanted to do. And they've had to do it very, very carefully and think a lot about what they were going to do and do it economically, and they had the support of the community. They'd fundraise and all this, but they never had money to blow. And this was the case with this bridge. And I thought, gosh, we're never going to make it, And then a certain councillor who was chairman of the Parks Committee, not a rotund person, but a well-built person, walked across the bridge and it shook under his weight. And he says, this bridge has to be replaced. And I thought, oh no, now the gun's pointed at us, you know, we've got to do it. And you know, I don't know how long we'd put this off, but at that very time, a bequest came to the Parks Department of $1,000, I think it was, by a dear lady who didn't specify what it was to be used for. And we have the bridge.
Oh, yeah.
And we have the plaque. Here we have the little plaque which says, this bridge was built with a request from a bequest from Eva Alice Wood and was dedicated to her memory in February 1978. So 2 years. 2 years we dallied trying to find the means of being able to produce a bridge which we thought appropriate to the place.
What's the loading on it now, Bridget?
I'm not sure the technicalities of it.
We don't want a cave crew.
I think it's safe. There's a lot of people gone over there. You will see at the other side something which I'm rather disturbed about, the TSB Bank playground, and we'll talk about sponsorship later. I divorced myself from any association with that particular sponsorship. It happened in my time, but I had absolutely nothing to do with it. And I was rather outraged when it was put through, and the suggestion was that entrance would be put here. I said, no way am I going to have this bridge and this water wheel associated with a sponsorship that is of that nature. And we had it shifted to that side. Anyway.
Why is the wheel never running?
Never working.
Well, yeah, why is the wheel never running? That's a course of acute embarrassment. I found the wheel out at the Amata Dairy Factory one day when I was out there. They had a power cut, and the subject of the power source of the past had arisen, and they said they had a water wheel out the back, you know, but it didn't work anymore. I said, could I have a look at it? And lo and behold, it was just the sized wheel that would fit into that gully there. You'd have to realise that there was no development of that gully at that time. It was just a derelict gully. We've heard that before, haven't we? Anyway, I got permission to retrieve what bits there were of it. All the cast iron work was intact. And there was a pond there, and some of the woodwork underneath had been preserved. So we had material from which we could reconstruct the original wheel. And it was proposed as our 1976 centennial project. And it was even financed partly by, what was it those days? All the names have changed these days. Taranaki County, I think it was. Anyway, when it was a functional wheel, it used to drive the churns, of course, at the Amata Dairy Factory. And the wheel, the spokes in that were attached to the hub by wedges, and it only, of course, worked a few hours a day. They'd run the thing while they were doing the churning. And when it was not in use, somebody used to go around and just tap these wedges and keep them in check. We, of course, had to adjust it so that it would just be free running without a load, without carrying a load. And we used the wedges originally, but we found that in continuous operation, it weighs about a ton, and it carries water, of course, of some weight. This ton of stuff in structure in operation just tested every weakness in the wheel, and it gradually loosened all these parts. And we used to keep on tapping them in, but we couldn't keep up with it. So all sorts of ideas over the years were devised to sort of make this part of the wheel secure, but it's never succeeded. It's beaten us every time. We've had very, very clever engineers come in and say, well, we need to do this, and they've done that, and it doesn't work. It catches everybody out continuously.
A water wheel would be a fairly simple sort of
thing. It's uncanny, yeah. We thought, look, we built it with great precision. When we put it in, it only required a bucket full. That's 10 litres of water in one of the buckets to make it go round. You know, it was free running. We had a tolerance of less than 20 millimetres when it rotated. It was all accurately balanced and everything. And it, in continuous action, it's beaten us all the time. So it can't be, it still hasn't been solved.
Quite a feature, it's a feature, but it's not.
It's terrible, yeah. During my time, I was able to keep it going most of the time, but it's been pulled out twice now, you know. They put a big crane in here and pull it out amongst all these trees. Incidentally, when we made it, it was made in four sections, the actual rim of the wheel, because I didn't want to destroy any of this vegetation around here. And we actually carried it all down by hand in pieces and rebuilt it down there. It was prefabricated in a factory and then taken to pieces and reconstructed down there. So we go down and have a closer look at it. It's a wonderful site. I mean, again, it's one of those things, those architectural things that's been brought into the park, but it doesn't intrude into the park. It's where a water wheel should be and would be, and it's unique in that you can view it from above and you can view it from below and you can even view it from behind. Now, I better keep walking because we're not going to make it, are we? The tree above us here is Ginkgo biloba, the maidenhair tree, another one from China, and another very, very primitive tree. The leaf shape is distinctive. You can see it on the ground there. It's sometimes called a maidenhair tree because these leaves look like the little segments of the maidenhair fern. There's a close example of the lily pilly berries. They're edible. We used to eat them as kids. Monkey apples, that's what we called them. Now we're going down the track to the water wheel, and above our heads is a little warbler calling away. Now, if you want to see the fruit potential of the lily pilly, look at this one here. It's just almost as if it's covered with snow. This track we had to cut out of the bank, you know, and form up. It didn't exist before the water wheel. And we had to take trees up. I've got a photograph of me way up a tree here taking it down in pieces because we didn't want to fill it and knock everything about. We get a good view here of the new, what would we call it? The new structures to cope with the flood potential. We've now come down below head level from Smith Walk, and would you believe in that last flood that we had, do you know where the water level was? Up here.
Oh, really?
Above our heads. It was just lapping Smith Walk up there where those lily pillies are. That's how much water there was here. And at that height, it just flowed over onto Gilbert Street, down Gilbert Street, under Victoria Road, got speed up down the hill across Carrington Street and did all the damage. Now, what they have built is a new... The whole problem arose because when Gilbert Street was developed, the culvert was put under it, and it coped well with the flood situations of that day, but they're totally different now. The water course has totally changed. No, the pipe is there. On one occasion, they actually put a foundation through it, but that was taken out again. Well, it was built over when they made Gilbert Street. Gilbert Street was, again, like Phyllis Street. There was a big gully there, and it was only a paper road for a while. the culvert that they put underneath it was sufficient at that time. But you see, 50% of the catchment is now solid. You know, it's roofs and tar seal and all that sort of thing. So when it rains, You get a flash flood situation, which never existed in those days, so the dimensions don't handle it anymore. But what they have done is they've driven a tunnel through to the Huatoki stream, a big one, as big as that there. It's, about 1.2 metres, I think it is. It's 4 feet. And we don't actually see the tunnel. That's an entrance to a chamber where, when this sort of flow is going through, it goes through the old system, the original system. But if it gets up to a certain point, it then starts to flow down that big tunnel. We can't see it. It goes down that way. They had to buy that house over there, I believe, because they drove this tunnel right underneath it.
And where's this water coming from?
This is the whole catchment for Pukekura.
I see.
And it starts away up at Hori Street.
Yes.
Up Carrington Way there, Carrington Roadway, or Carrington Street Way. Well, it's incredible. As we go around the corner here to see the water wheel, we see a chute which handles all the water coming through Pukekura Park, and that was measured within this last month, and there were only 2 millimetres of water coming down that chute. That was the total volume of water serving all those lakes of Pukekura Park. Now, I have on record of having said that the greatest threat to Pukekura Park for the future is not what people might do to it, but the fact that the water flow will diminish to the point where we'll just have stagnant lakes. And it's happened this year. That is not sufficient water to keep a garden pond fresh. So that is a big threat for the future. You can see now the significance of the bridge as we look at the water wheel from here. And again, if you want to get a picture of how deep the water was when that flood came, it was up to the third railing on the bridge.
Oh, right.
So that's, I don't know, it's probably almost 15 metres of water depth. Right, we'll go forward to the bridge, to the water wheel now. We have a little plaque on the on this wheel here, which gives details of the history of the wheel. Yes, now looking back at the wheel, we see quite a number of its interesting features. You can see, for one thing, that one of the buckets is broken out of it. When we built this wheel, and it was done by our own staff, when I say we built it, when we installed it rather, we knew that most of our work would not be seen because it's all down there under the water. You have to realise that when we did this, we had to handle the water that was coming down. It had to go somewhere. We had to dig down to achieve solid foundations to bear that ton of weight there. So it had to be very, very secure foundations. I think it was about 4 or 5 metres we had to dig down through years of sludge and junk and bottles and all sorts of things. To come down to sound base, we had to dig everything out so that we could put those pillars, build those pillars solidly. And we built a sort of a Chinese water course over the top here to take the water over our heads and hope that it didn't rain for the whole time we were down there, because it would have all filled up again. And it was quite hair-raising in a way. You can see there's a very big wall now, and you imagine that wall goes right down several metres under the water, and that is built with prisoner labour blocks that were retrieved from the curbs of the downtown, and I think many of them came from the vault of the old post office. So they are historic stones also. We realised pretty early on that if we were pretty cute, we could make it so that people would not only view the wheel, but be able to go behind it. And so we had to make this walkway continuous so that you could go down one side and up the other. And that was a challenge in itself, because again, we had to get foundations for that walkway in it. Somebody already mentioned the Cave Creek problem with the bridge above. Well, this was equally as important, that it had to withstand unknown amounts of numbers of people walking across it. And really, it is quite an experience to go behind. Well, not now because the wheel's not working, but there was a wonderful concept of power in that when the wheel was working and you could go behind it, especially at night. And me oh my, when the water level rises in that chute so that it's filling the chute and then it's overfilling into the one that feeds the wheel, it's quite a mighty experience to see that power of water coming over the top there. So, yeah, it's been very, very satisfying in many ways, and sadness that we can't overcome these mechanical problems to keep the wheel going. It's, I'd prefer not to think about the number of hours that I personally put in, first of all, you know, installing the wheel and then trying to keep it going over the years. It's a lovely setting though, isn't it? It's really magical. I mean, if there's something that one could be really satisfied about, it's just the way that whole thing worked out. Yeah. Yes, it's been out twice, I think, for a total... oh, look, I have seen so many engineers come into that wheel and say, yes, we got the answer. And and it's caught everyone so far. Yes. Yes, some of the later developments, you know, I'm very impressed. You'd have to believe that they will work, but it gets the better of the system every time. We could perhaps turn to the right here. We go through a little grove of totaras, a native tree.
And the wall is built of crude stones, and what else?
Big blocks, stones from that had been used in the construction of the post office vault. That's true with the stones at the waterfall also.
Yes,
they're also of that nature. The squarish ones.
Thank you.
Right, now we're emerging into the children's playground, and we see it's a pretty well used place.
Well used.
Yeah. This is another one of the open areas in the park for which we thank John Goodwin. He had the wisdom to know that to really appreciate a place, you have to be able to stand back and look at it. Pardon. And places like the Goodwin Dell, the Hatchery Lawn, in this area in particular, he made sure that there were open spaces. And he realised that this was a wonderful place for a playground because it doesn't matter what wind is blowing, somewhere in Pukekura Park you'll be away from it. And in this particular area, you're missing a great deal of it. So it's a nice sheltered area. And it again captured the imagination of groups like the JCs and the Lions, and they got behind the project. And they built the toilet facilities, they built the paddling pool, one built one and one built the other. And that was why, when it was proposed that the playground be upgraded, I was pretty upset about the fact that it had to rely on sponsorship. One of the regrets I have of my time at the park was that I didn't upgrade the playground earlier, because it was very, very simple. It was a simple playground, but it needed things like a good slide. It didn't have a slide. And I always imagined the wonderful one down at Kawara Park, you know, that where you slide down the bank. There's no danger. Well, I mean, I suppose there's danger kids hurtling down at too great a speed, but nowhere for them to fall. And I thought, you know, we should have done something like that here, but I never got around to it. And then the decision was made to upgrade it, and a few factors came together over which I had no control. And as a means of financing it, sponsorship was sought, and that's something that hadn't happened in Pukekura Park before. And one of the conditions of the sponsorship was that we have those entranceways. Now, up until that event, any contribution of any sort into the park was recognised by a plaque. And we've seen a few of them as we've walked.